All right, good morning, everybody. It is Wednesday morning after a long weekend. We had Monday off, so this is now Wednesday, September 8th, and 9 a.m., and we're doing Chem 12BL. Okay, and we were working on the Grignard experiment, and as we were just discussing before the majority of people came in working on that Grignard experiment, we had left off somewhere in the middle of the Grignard experiment as I was explaining it, and I said that we would pick it up with that explanation moving forward today. But also, you guys have had some time to maybe go and watch that video. And I suspect that maybe some of you have watched the video, maybe not. Maybe none of you have watched it. In which case, if nobody has watched the videos, then I'm going to pick up where I left off and just keep talking about the experiment itself. But if along the way, if you have watched some of the videos and started taking some notes or have questions regarding what you observed in the videos, then anytime, breaking in anytime is a great time for those sorts of questions. So let me go ahead and go into the iPad. Let's take a look at where we left off, and then we'll pick up with a new note for today and do it that way. All right, so under Chem 12, OCHEM lab notes, this was our last lecture. We had talked about sand baths. We had talked about bringing out the glassware and assembling the glassware. So I had kind of left off around bringing out the glassware. And I believe it was a question from Reto that had indicated or observed that the round bottom doesn't make real good contact with the hot plate. And how are we heating this round bottom if it's not making good contact? And we talked about some other ways to heat round bottoms, but that this round bottom and this reaction is a very exothermic reaction. And because it's so exothermic that this round bottom does not need to be heated, we're really using this as a support so that the round bottom has some support, it's not just hanging in the air, but also we put a magnetic spin vane in there and we're using this for the spinning in order to agitate the reaction, rather than actually trying to heat the reaction. So that was kind of where we left off. So we were at step three, bringing out the glassware and assembling while hot so that we have this entire assembly. So what we've got now, just looking at this assembly, is we've got a drying tube with calcium chloride beads in here. The calcium chloride acts as a desiccant. That allows moist air to come in through this, what is called a Claisen adapter. The air comes into the Claisen and into the round bottom and is dried as it passes through the calcium chloride beads. And now this thing is open to the air. So as this drying tube is open to the air, it allows air to go both out and in. So as the round bottom heats, as the reaction takes place and vapors are produced, those vapors can exit this. And if it cools down, air can travel in and replace the vacuum that would be developing inside of that. So that's the whole setup. And the most important aspect of that is that we always have an opening of some sort. No matter what type of reaction it is, no matter if it's air sensitive or if it's not air sensitive, the biggest thing about doing a chemical reaction is always making sure that it has some way to be able to vent. Otherwise, it's not called a chemical reaction anymore. If you close the vent, if you were to cap this and then proceed, it's not called a chemical reaction anymore. Does anybody know what it's called if you cap it and then try to move forward and heating and doing other things?
Explosion, like it's a physical thing?
Yeah, it's called a bomb. That's when we make bombs. So one of the biggest things that I can teach you guys about organic chemistry is to not make bombs, never make bombs. Even when the reactions are extremely dangerous by air-sensitive materials and the materials can explode when exposed to air or moisture, we always have a special type of valve that allows air out but not allows air back in. Just in case pressure builds up, it's a check valve of sorts, but just in case pressure builds up, you always have to have some sort of exit. Otherwise, the device can explode. And so we're very, very careful that anytime we build an apparatus like this, that we always check to make sure that that air is able to flow in and out of the apparatus before we ever start heating or before we ever start the reaction. That's the biggest thing to watch for in any of these types of reactions and apparatuses. Okay.
So with the drying agents here, just quick, like if we could use silica gel, or that's not good enough of a drying
agent? No, silica gel is not good enough. You need something that is really very hygroscopic. You want something that is going to suck up water fast because you have very little length. I mean, most of these things are maybe 4 inches, 5 inches in height. And so the amount of time that the air travels through this and passes through this is very small. Silica gel can be used if you have a closed container and it's in a desiccator and you want to absorb moisture that is a fixed amount of moisture. But if you're bringing in wet air on a constant basis, then you need a material that can really handle that. And so we want something that's really hygroscopic. Calcium chloride is one of the best for that type of thing. All right, let me, I should have done this before and I didn't. What I need to do real quick is I need to find the Grignard experiment where I was drawing this before. Okay, and now once I'm set there, now when I go back and start a new note, now I can find that one easily to pull in drawings. So this will be Grignard experiment, synthesis of triphenyl methanol. Second day. Okay, so that's where we're at. And then in addition to that, I need to be able to see my notes. And I'm gonna pull the chat so I can see the chat. All right, so I won't be able to see you guys so much. So if you need to break in or ask a question, just break in and ask a question or throw it in the chat because I'll be able to see that. And then I've got my notes up here to be able to see as well. Okay, I think that one of the things that I forgot to do in the last part is I said that we added the magnesium turnings to the round bottom when we assembled it hot. So I'm gonna say that this is sort of like step 2A, because we were on step 3, I believe. Let's go back and see what step we were on. Yeah, we were on step 3. So this is going to be sort of like step 2A that was way out 0.15 grams of magnesium turnings. And then in step 3, you add the magnesium. To the round bottom flask. While assembling the glassware. So that was one of the things that I kind of had skipped over or missed. The magnesium turnings, let's talk about the magnesium turnings for a minute. The magnesium turnings, the reason that we use magnesium turnings is that their ease of use. We could use magnesium ribbon, we could use any form of magnesium, but magnesium turnings have, they're like little spiral shapes here. And they are literally what they say, they're turnings. And so if you imagine that somebody has magnesium that they are shaping on a lathe, and they, as the magnesium is spinning, they cut the magnesium. These are the turnings that come off that magnesium, and they're actually quite small. So if I were to draw sort of like actually how small they are, they're usually about that size, not much bigger than the letters that I'm writing. They're fairly small. And the interesting thing about magnesium is that when you look at magnesium metal, if we say that this is the thickness of the metal, magnesium being an alkaline earth metal is very reactive with moisture and water. And like most metals, what it does is it forms an oxide coating. And so out here on the outside, all the way around it, is this oxide coating. And this is magnesium oxide. The problem with the magnesium oxide coating is that this is magnesium, which is in a 2+ state, and oxygen, which is in a 2- state. And so the whole Grignard reaction relies on the magnesium being in the 0 state, right? And so what we need is we need to have the alkyl halide reacting with magnesium in the 0 state, and it transfers electrons in a redox reaction, which then results in the magnesium giving away 2 of electrons. And this becomes minus and that becomes minus. And so the magnesium must have 2 electrons to give away to make the reaction work. If the magnesium metal is already in a 2+ state out on the surface, then the reaction cannot work. And so we need to remove the magnesium oxide coating in order for this reaction to work. That's not easy to do. One way is that if it is a ribbon, then we could go through and we could use steel wool or sandpaper to remove the oxide coating. However, that oxide coating starts to rebuild really quickly. And anytime you use something like steel wool, it always has oil and grease on it. That imparts oil and grease into our reaction. If you use sandpaper, that imparts all of these little particles and dust and other things that can get trapped into our reaction. That also doesn't work. So I'm not a fan of using an abrasive material to remove the oxide coating. And to remove it chemically also doesn't work real well. This is where these magnesium turnings come into play, because what we can do with the magnesium turning is we can take the magnesium turning, let's imagine that it's sort of sitting on its side like this. And what we've got here is a glass rod that comes down with a smashed end on the glass rod. And what we do is we push on it as it sits on the glass bottom, and we smash it. And when you smash the magnesium turning, there's air and space inside of it. And so literally what happens to that turning is that if we imagine that turning as sort of a roll, it breaks and fragments on the edges, and this exposes fresh magnesium. And that fresh magnesium then allows the reaction to kick off and start. And as the reaction starts, it will eat the inside of the magnesium oil, leaving the oxide coating on the outside just in the reaction. And that magnesium oxide doesn't hurt anything. It'll just be some leftover material at the end of the reaction. And so what we're going to do is we're going to smash this in a very particular way. And I'll explain in a few minutes. Let's go ahead and move on to the next step. And let me explain what we do next here. So step number 6, or actually on my paper it's 6, but this is really going to be step number 4. I have the steps listed in different orders. What we're going to do is we're going to use a 5-milliliter conical vial. These 5-milliliter conical vials are shaped as reaction vessels themselves, but we can also use them for mixing. They have a conical shaped interior, and they have gradations on them on the outside that tell you the volume that you place into them. And the top of them is threads to take a lid that can go onto this. And they hold a maximum of 5 milliliters. And they're pretty pretty good for making solutions in. So we use a 5 milliliter conical vial. We tear the vial. We add approximately 0.7 milliliters of bromobenzene. And then we go ahead and reweigh the conical vial to figure out exactly how much bromobenzene we used. This is sort of a critical step right here, this tear and reweigh, because the bromobenzene is our starting material. It's one of the starting materials that is going to determine the percent yield of the chemical reaction once we figure out what our limiting reagent is. And our limiting reagent is going to be different for everybody, because notice that what I say here is I say approximately. And our volumes are always approximate additions. We always use a calibrated pasture pipette to transfer an approximate amount of a volume. And then once we transfer that approximate value, we always go by mass. So does anybody know why we don't use an exact volume? And instead of using exact volume, why do we go for mass instead of volume?
Is it displacement of whatever material to be in there to displace the volume?
Yeah, displacement could be an issue, but let's say that we're working in something like a calibrated conical vial here that's got gradations on it. We still wouldn't use volume. We'd still want to go for mass.
There's temperature and like meniscus and stuff. It's hard to read.
Ah, okay. So you said temperature. Why did you say temperature?
Because like if it's 25 degrees, it's a different volume depending on the material. So
that's the answer.
Check okay. One more vial. One
that's
more.
That's the answer. Density. Density is proportional to temperature. It changes with temperature. And that means that volume changes with temperature. Mass is independent. Mass is constant. Mass does not depend on temperature at all. So what happens is, you know, if your temp goes up, your volume goes up.
So reading from the graduations is accurate enough if you know how to do it right?
No, I would say that if you knew what the density was, if you had a chart of very specific densities and you also took an accurate temperature and then you read an accurate volume, you could calculate out what the mass is. But that's just a pain in the tuchus. I mean, there's no reason to try to go through all that work when all you got to do is put it on a balance and get the mass directly. So mass is always what we go for, because mass is independent.
Because gravity is more constant than temperature.
Well, yes. That's what, I mean, that's how we measure mass. Is mass is usually done by using gravity on a balance. And yes, the gravity is going to be as constant as we can get it. It's just a much more accurate way of determining the mass. And I can see that my screen just froze too. So it was starting to write and it wasn't going with what I was writing.
At the Olympics, there was a thing that high jump is gravity dependent, and it makes up about a centimeter or so from location to location.
That's funny. That's independent of temp. So we always go with mass. Along those same lines with the Olympics, the reason that they time all the swimming events in hundreds of seconds is because the length of swimming pools from place to place is not consistent enough to be able to time into the thousands of seconds. And so because of their limit to be able to measure the distance of a swimming pool, it doesn't make sense to time athletes to any greater degree than a thousandth of a second or a hundredth of a second. Same sort of thing. It's interesting that our ability to measure has gotten so good that it actually factors into things like the Olympics and being able to ascertain how closely somebody has broken a record, a world record or an Olympic record. It's really an interesting concept. Okay, back to what I need to do here. Okay, then what we're going to do is the next step here is we add approximately 4 milliliters of anhydrous diethyl ether.
Is this step five?
It's going into the conical vial. So it's along this, actually, let's do it this way. Let's take this. Let's move this down as a note. This is the next step here because we're making a solution rather than just adding the bromobenzene. So the bromobenzene is the reactant. Now what we're going to do is we're going to make a solution out of that reactant. So we add 4 milliliters of anhydrous diethyl ether to the conical vial. You can probably hear my dogs in the background. I'm actually back in Monterey today instead of up in the Bay Area. So I've got different issues. Instead of cars, planes, trains, and people, I've got dogs. They'll bark once in a while. They don't, generally don't go off too much. Hopefully they're not too distracting. There's not a whole lot I can do about them. They're just the way they are. All right, add 4 milliliters of anhydrous diethyl ether to the conical vial and stir it and mix so that we make a solution. So this is now a solution of bromobenzene in diethyl ether. And that solution is what we are going to use to do the chemical reaction. So now what we're going to do is use a syringe. This is the next step. So this would be, what are we on, step five. We use a, I guess it's like a 3 milliliter syringe. To add approximately 1 milliliter of the bromobenzene solution into the round bottom flask. Through the septa. So what this looks like when you do it, let me grab this setup here, and then I'll kind of explain what this looks like. The rubber septum that we have here, the rubber septum is sitting right here, and that syringe is a 3 milliliter syringe. And what we do is we take and it has a cap. I'm gonna get rid of the cap because we don't need the cap. But this piece, the needle, goes on here and screws onto it. It's called a lure lock. And so we screw that needle onto that lure lock. And then once that's screwed in place, we have our solution that is in our 5 mil conical vial. This is sort of a better image of the conical vial. And with that conical vial here, what I'm gonna do, and these are sized a little bit bigger than they should be, that's probably much closer to what they actually look like size-wise. What we do with that is we grab the solution out of the conical vial, and then we take that syringe and we jam that syringe into here. into the septa. And so the syringe sits right in the septa there. And then we add in the 1 milliliter. And we just push the plunger down and we pass it through that rubber septum, which is a self-closing thing. And this syringe can just sit inside that septum while the reaction takes place. And it's just a convenient place to hold the syringe. And so now what happens is, now we've got solution that is sitting in here. We've got about a mil, and that milliliter just about covers the stir bar and the magnesium turnings. So we have added in approximately 1 mil of solution. Now, what I need to do is now I need to kickstart this chemical reaction. This is the part where I open up the round bottom, take the round bottom off, and I use a glass stirring rod in order to be able to go in and smash the magnesium. And I prefer to do this rather than allowing you guys to do this, because there's some risk involved in terms of if you don't understand exactly what it is you're trying to achieve, or if you don't understand how fragile the round bottom is, you risk punching through the bottom of the round bottom with the glass rod. And so at this point, what I ask people to do is to call me over, and then I crush the magnesium. So this next step, I gotta watch my numbers. What am I on, six? Step six is call me over to crush magnesium. And what I literally do is I take the round bottom off. And in taking the round bottom off, I take it over to a fume hood. And you've got the spin vein that's in here. And then you've got all these little magnesium turnings. And the magnesium is sitting in and around this. And I use a glass stir rod that I've already smashed the end on and made a little flat sort of mortar, to use like a mortar and pestle, or I guess this would be the pestle part. And what I do is I just insert that into the thing here, and it's actually got quite a long stem on this glass rod. And I give downwards force and rotational force. And I continue to grind that magnesium as it sits under the solution. And I grind magnesium until I see turbidity. Until the solution turns turbid. That turbidity indicates to me that the reaction is started. So turbid is a word that we use that describes a solution. Solutions are clear and colorless when everything is dissolved in them. When we start to see turbidity, it starts to turn a little bit gray. It starts to have some opaqueness to it, the beginning, very beginning of opaqueness. And that turbidity signals that, that the Grignard reaction is starting to work. And once you see that turbidity, the reaction is going to go and catalyze itself and auto-catalyze. And so then I take and return the round bottom back onto the apparatus. And at that point, the reaction is going. So now it's just a series of additions and running the reaction. So step number seven here is going to look like adding remaining bromobenzene solution. Via syringe. To the reaction over 15 minutes. You want to add at a rate below boiling. So what you do is you add like a quarter mil. You give it a minute or two to see what happens with the reaction. If the reaction starts boiling, then you stop and you let the reaction calm down, let the reaction stop boiling, and then add just a little bit more. You'll see the reaction will kick up to the boiling point again. You'll see bubbles starting to come off of it. You let it rest and you just keep giving little additions over the next 15 minutes until you add all of the remaining bromobenzene solution. You had 4 mils to add, approximately almost 5 mils to add, because you had 0.7 mils of the bromobenzene and you had 4 mils of diethyl ether. So you've got about 5 mils here that you're adding, and we want to add it over the 15 minutes. Once you've added all of the bromobenzene solution, then we want to make sure that we police the round bottom or police the conical vial and get all the bromobenzene out of the conical vial. And we do that by rinsing the conical vial with 2 mils of diethyl ether, fresh diethyl ether. So we rinse conical vial with 2 milliliters fresh diethyl ether. And add to the reaction.
So here we're using slow addition to avoid violent boiling.
Yes.
Why are we not using like boiling stones?
Well, boiling stones won't stop something from boiling. Boiling stones will help to see the boiling. Boiling stones will communicate that something, when you use boiling stones, the reason to use a boiling stone is because organic solvents don't usually boil on their own. What happens is that you can superheat organic solvents. And then when you add some solid to the solvent that is above its boiling point, it explosively boils and it can bump and explosively explode out of the container. It can be a very dangerous situation because then if it's superheated, it's above its boiling point and it explodes and you're over a hot plate, any solvent that hits the hot plate can flash. The vapors then can create a fireball and the whole thing can turn into a fireball. It can be extremely dangerous. So boiling stones allow a material to boil normally by giving it little pockets where air bubbles can form. Not air bubbles, I should say gas bubbles, because it's really the gaseous solvent that is being created, not air at all. But that gaseous solvent then can transition in that pocket from liquid form to gas form and then can erupt out normally. And it allows the material to boil at its normal boiling temperature. Putting boiling stones in this wouldn't prevent it from boiling. What we really want is we really don't want it to get so hot that it does boil. We want it to just stay right at the cusp of the boiling point. And the magnesium turnings and other solids that we have in here and the spin vein allow it to boil at its normal temperature, not explosively. So it's not that we're trying to prevent it from explosively boiling. We're just trying to prevent a runaway reaction. See, what happens is, as you're adding the bromobenzene solution, the reaction is taking place. If you add too much bromobenzene, the reaction can run away from you. It can heat so quickly that you wouldn't be able to control the boiling and you would boil off the diethyl ether. But by keeping it below its boiling point, we allow the reaction to proceed at a nice calm rate. And we need to control the rate of addition in order to control the exothermic nature of the reaction. I hope
we don't bother with a water bath here to cool it down more because it's just not necessary.
It's too
complex.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly could. That's another way to control a reaction, is to cool a reaction in order to control the exothermic nature of it. That's another way to do it. But we run a fine line of, if the reaction doesn't heat up a little bit, it doesn't progress well. The heat actually helps to catalyze it. And so we want it to heat, but we don't want it to heat too much. So the boiling point of diethyl ether is right around 35 degrees Celsius. So we want to hit a temperature of right around 35 degrees Celsius, somewhere around 32 to 35 is sort of an ideal temperature for this reaction to go on. There are other ways to do this reaction besides the way that we're advocating here, but they're limited in you need the right sort of equipment to be able to do it. So one of the other ways to do a chemical reaction like this is to not have to crush the diethyl ether, but to take and use what's called a sonicator. Sonicator, like a jewelry cleaner. And inside the sonicator is a water bath. The temperature of the water bath can be controlled. This thing gets plugged in, has a little timer on it that we set. And the round bottom and all of the apparatus would sit down into the sonicator. So we would have the Claisen adapter that would sit here. We would have the drying tube. We'd have all of that other stuff that goes on this thing. And this whole apparatus would then go down into, this is not going to work for me. Let me try this again. This would all fit down into the sonicator. And then what happens here in the sonicator is that this produces sonic waves. And the sonic waves crash right through the glass and they wind up hitting the magnesium turnings. And they blow off the magnesium oxide coating, just like you would clean jewelry. They blow off the magnesium oxide coating right off of the magnesium. And then they allow this reaction to continue. And you can also set the temperature. The problem with a sonicator like this is that it's an expensive piece of equipment. And I don't have 15, 20 sonicators for every student to be able to use. Well, I don't even have 10. What I have is one, right? And so oftentimes I'll demonstrate and I'll put the sonicator into the fume hood and I'll set up a reaction in the sonicator and allow students to see how the sonicator reaction can differ from the reaction that they're doing. And it does allow you to be able to add in, because you can control the temperature, it allows you to add in the bromobenzene in more of a single shot. And you can kind of control the reaction as it goes, and the sonicator helps to make the reaction go. But this is expensive and difficult.
Thanks.
So there are different ways to be able to accomplish this. It's just that we're trying to make it work with the equipment that we have. So that's how we do it, is we just control the rate of addition as opposed to trying to control the temperature. All right, so we rinse the conical vial with 2 mL of fresh diethyl ether, and we add that to the reaction. And then we use the same conical vial. You save same 5 mL conical vial to tear. Add approximately 1.09 grams of benzophenone. And this is a solid, so we can weigh this out. And then we add, or reweigh, I should say, reweigh the conical vial. And benzophenone. By the way, I had an exchange with a student regarding, why am I tearing these things and then reweighing them? Why don't I just weigh the solid directly or weigh it on a piece of weighing paper and then add it? And the answer to that question is that when you tear something and then you reweigh it, you're weighing by difference. And the reason that we like to weigh by difference is that if the balance were to have a calibration error, let's say that the balance weighed 0.02 grams heavy or 0.2 grams heavy. Let's just say that it had an error in the balance where it was weighing heavy constantly. If you tear the device and then you add your solid and then you reweigh the device, the subtraction subtracts out the error and you get the true weight. So if a balance is calibrated incorrectly, you can still get accurate weighings as long as you do it by difference. And that weighing by difference will allow you to get the accurate weight as opposed to an incorrect weight. So we always like to weigh by difference. It seems like it's an extra step. And why am I doing this extra step? Let's just get the mass, cut to the chase. And the answer is this is a more accurate way of doing things. And it takes into account a balance that may have a calibration error in it. So something to be aware of. Okay, so we reweigh the conical vial, and then what we do is we add 2 mL of diethyl ether and we stir and mix this to make a solution. Add approximately 2 mL of diethyl ether. And mix to make homogeneous. So we make a homogeneous solution of that benzophenone. So benzophenone, by the way, since we're writing each of these things, maybe I should be giving you the structures too, rather than just the names. This is benzophenone. Benzophenone is a ketone that has two aromatic rings on either side. So there's benzophenone. And up here, we were using bromobenzene. The bromobenzene is benzene with just a bromine on it. So that's our bromobenzene that we're making. So here, what we're doing is we have made the Grignard. Now we are going to use the Grignard in order to react with benzophenone to make the new carbon-carbon bond. So here we're going to use the syringe to transfer the benzophenone solution to the round bottom flask. This is step number 10. So use same syringe. To transfer benzophenone solution to the round bottom flask. You want to do this quickly. This is very exothermic. We want to do this quickly, but and this is a big but try to keep it below boiling. And what's taking place here is at this step, we have already made the Grignard. And what we are doing is we are adding the benzophenone solution in diethyl ether. And the Grignard reagent is making the new carbon-carbon bond with the benzophenone. This is acting as a carbanion. This is your electrophilic carbon. And what is happening is the carbanion is attacking the electrophilic carbon, breaking the bond here, and kicking the electrons up onto the oxygen. This makes what we call an adduct. It's not the final product. It's just the bringing together of the two molecules. And it leaves an O minus, for which the counter ion is the magnesium and the bromide. So what we've literally done is this guy is added into the molecule and made a new carbon-carbon bond. So that's my new carbon-carbon bond that I've made. And this is now an alkoxide anion. And this is ionic in nature and not soluble in diethyl ether. So what you see as you add this in is that this crashes out as a solid. When you're watching the video, it's really pretty. This is a great step to watch in the video, because as I go in and I add that benzophenone solution, there's a color change that occurs in the chemical reaction. It turns brilliant red, and then the red sort of fades to a pink, and then the pink sort of fades to a gray as the reaction takes place. And it just solidifies. There's a tremendous amount of solid that drops out of the chemical reaction as this is taking place. And it's just a beautiful step to watch in the chemical reaction. So once this adduct forms, once the alkoxide ion forms, the chemical reaction is essentially over. We have finished the reaction stage and we move into the workup stage. And so this is where we would normally store the chemical reaction. This is end of day one, safe to store is what we say. It's safe to store as the alkoxide. And reaction is over. Now we start workup phase, workup and isolation. Okay. The workup is interesting. The workup requires requires some care. This is usually day two on the reaction. So we come back in, we open up these round bottoms, and the solid is been capped and sitting in your locker. It's usually a gray solid. What we do is we take, and in step one of the workup, we add 6 milliliters of 6 molar hydrochloric acid. And we add it dropwise to the round bottom flask. And I always make big of this idea that this is dropwise, that we got to be really careful when you first add this, because this is extremely exothermic.
Is that a standard symbol with the M that has a line underneath it?
Yeah. Molarity always has a line underneath it. The idea behind putting a line underneath it is that molarity is an italicized M, so 6 molar. But if you're going to do it in print and it's not italicized, then you use the underscore, and the underscore means italic. That's just standard. There we go.
You do either italic or underscores.
Yeah, and so a single underscore means italic. Single underscore. And a double underscore means bold. And you'll oftentimes see this not only when you're looking at writing something that is italic or bold, but oftentimes when you see people doing references in a journal, the references in the journal may say something like Jack's Journal of Organic Chemistry or the Journal of the American Chemical Society. 1943, 1701, and what they'll do is they'll do a single underscore and a double underscore, meaning one is bold and one is italic. The bold is the year, the italic is the page number. So this would be the year and the page number. And it's a way of communicating differences between years and page numbers when you're looking at references like that. And so it's just a standard way of writing and communicating bold and italic. So when you see something that is underscored single, it's italic. When you see something that's underscored double, it's bold. And so molarity is always supposed to be italic. And so they indicate it with a single underscore line. All these little things you guys are learning. Who knew?
There's so many weird details that are not in the textbook.
There are, absolutely.
They just, are?
Not that they are in the textbook, but that you're right, that they're not in the textbook and that you learn them along the way. Okay, so in this step, what's happening is we're taking this adduct that we've made that has the alkoxide anion, and we are protonating it. So we are going from the O minus that has the magnesium and the bromide, and we are adding HCl. And in the process, we are protonating the alkoxide, which is why this is so exothermic. It's an acid-base reaction. And you're taking a very strong base and you're protonating a very strong base using a pretty damn strong acid. So we get OH, and we wind up making magnesium chloride bromide. So it's a mixed salt. That we wind up making. And what happens here is that when you look at the round bottom, you know, you had some undissolved or unreacted magnesium turnings that were in here. And the reaction winds up going biphasic. The top layer up here is diethyl ether. The bottom layer down here is the aqueous water layer. And what's happening is on the surface, you'll see right at the interface here, you'll see some magnesium that's at that interface. And you'll see some gas bubbles that'll be coming off this magnesium as it's spinning. The gas bubbles that are coming off are hydrogen gas. What's happening is that the magnesium, which is in its zero state, is reacting with hydrochloric acid to produce hydrogen gas and magnesium chloride. And so this is a side reaction that is occurring that is destroying any leftover magnesium. But because of that, we need to be really careful that we continue to stir this until all the bubbling stops. Must continue stirring. Until all bubbling stops and both layers homogeneous. Let's say both layers clear and colorless.
So for the write-up, do you want like one big thing that has all these side reactions kind of like in one big diagram or something or not?
We're going to talk about the write-up and what I want the write-up to look like. We're going to talk about formal reports, and I'm going to show you an example of a formal report and what it is that I'm looking for. So in essence, yes, you're going to talk about all these things. It's just, where do I want you to talk about it? And how do I want you to talk about it? Yes. And you'll get a clearer picture too when you go through and you watch the video and you actually see what takes place and taking all the data. And you'll be able to then have all of your notes to be able to write the report from. Okay, so that's our first step, is where we add the 6 molar hydrochloric acid dropwise and we protonate the triphenyl methanol. And we have what's called a biphasic system. Okay, with the biphasic system, then what we do is we move it into a separatory funnel to isolate it. So we transfer the contents to a separatory funnel. Um, and extract the organic layer. So here's what this is looking like. A separatory funnel is a device that is sort of pear-shaped. It has a stopcock and usually a cut tapered end on it. And we put this thing into, I don't like that side of my separatory funnel. Let's try it one more time. Close enough. All right, so we put this into a ring stand. So there's a ring that goes around this guy and it locks into a ring stand. And then we use a series of Erlenmeyer flasks to receive the contents coming out of the separatory funnel. And we always like to have the separatory funnel dip slightly into the Erlenmeyer flask. In the separatory funnel, you have two layers. You have an organic layer and an aqueous layer. The aqueous layer contains your water and HCl and salts. Your organic layer contains the organic molecules that are in there. So up here, this is the diethyl ether. This is the triphenyl methanol. And other organics. Down here, this is your water, your HCl, and magnesium salts that we're separating out. And so the aqueous layer would come out first, and you would separate out the aqueous layer. And then in the next round or the next Erlenmeyer flask, we would want to place the organic layer, pulling them apart from each other. And then what we do in step three is we add the aqueous layer back into the separatory funnel. And you re-extract it. We re-extract with 5 mL of new fresh diethyl ether. What we're trying to do is make sure that we're not leaving any triphenyl methanol behind in the aqueous layer. So this is sort of like a policing step where we're trying to pull any remaining triphenyl methanol out of the aqueous layer, making sure that we're getting all of that. And you combine the organic layers. At this point, the aqueous layer is waste. Okay, then in step four, we do a pre-drying step. The pre-drying step is that we add the diethyl ether layers back into the SEP funnel and we wash it with 5 mL of brine solution. Brine solution is saturated sodium chloride. And what that brine solution does is diethyl ether is extremely hygroscopic with water, and it holds water tightly because it can hydrogen bond. What we do is by making a saturated sodium chloride solution up here, actually it's down here, the bottom layer is going to be water. Down here we have the water and we have all of these salts, sodium and chloride, and we have high concentration of sodium and chloride because it's saturated. And up here we have the diethyl ether layer. And what happens is any water that is in here tries to migrate into the aqueous layer to dilute down the sodium chloride. It's basically using osmotic pressure and salt solutions in order to pull the water out of the diethyl ether layer and move it into the aqueous layer. What's happening is the different solubilities of diethyl ether and water are creating sort of a semi-permeable membrane. There's the meniscus between the diethyl ether and the water, and the water will move through that barrier trying to dilute down the sodium chloride, and it acts as a pre-drying step. It removes some water from the diethyl ether. So once we do that, now we extract that again. So we've had our separatory funnel. The separatory funnel now has the two layers in it. We've got the aqueous layer that was the salt solution and the diethyl ether layer sitting up on top. This diethyl ether layer is now drier. And we extract these back into Erlenmeyer flasks again. And so we're gonna pull out the water. That's gonna become waste. And the diethyl ether has our product in it. And that is what we're going to follow and track with. So this is going to be my H2O, this is going to be waste, and this is going to be my organic, and this is my product. Okay. The next step that we do is we take, and this is step five, now we do a chemical drying. With magnesium sulfate. It's one of my favorite drying reagents to use. This is a solid material. We take that magnesium sulfate and we add an amount of magnesium sulfate that I always say is the right amount. And the right amount depends on how much water is still in your solution. So you kind of eyeball it. And the amount that we add, we observe and if it is clumping and the magnesium sulfate clumps all up and sticks in the bottom, then you haven't added enough. If the magnesium, when you swirl the flask, puffs up and looks sort of like a snow globe, then that means that there is dry magnesium sulfate that is in the flask, and that means that you've added enough. So we want it to snow globe, but we don't want to add too much. So clumping is wet. Free-flowing is dry. And what's happening here is the magnesium sulfate as a solid is reacting with water. And I believe it's seven waters to make magnesium sulfate heptahydrate. And this thing is a sticky solid, whereas this guy is a free-flowing solid. And so it allows you to be able to visually see when you have absorbed all the water out of the reaction flask, is by looking to see, is the magnesium free-flowing or is the magnesium sticky and forming a clump on the bottom of the flask? And so you just continue to add it until you get some free-flowing material and you know that you have chemically dried the material. Then from here, what we do is we decant this. We decant into a 25 mil round bottom flask. Decant means to pour slowly, leaving behind solid. Most instructors would say set up a filtration apparatus and pour it through the filtration apparatus, or to use some sort of filter paper or something to pour this through so that the solid doesn't go through. That just makes more things to clean and takes a lot more time. If you learn how to decant properly, if you learn how to pour slowly, and I show you in the video how to do it. It's easier to watch the video than it is to have me explain it here. But if you decant properly, you're not going to get any of the magnesium sulfate into the round bottom flask. And so basically what we do is you're just pouring this guy at a rate that keeps the solid behind. So the solid gets locked in here and you're pouring this into the round bottom flask and you get the solution that comes in. And then from here, what we're going to do is we're going to take this and we're going to rotovap it. So we decant into a 25 mil round bottom flask and then rotovap. Once we rotovap it off, we rotovap all of the solvent. A rotovap is a device that heats. So rotovap, what it does is it heats, it rotates, and it reduces pressure. And all of these three things increase evaporation rate. It's a way of evaporating solvents very, very quickly. And then once we rotovap that, what we get is a solid residue. So after rotovapping, we get a sticky solid residue. That sticky solid residue has a number of different things in it. It has in it our product, triphenylmethanol. So that guy is in there. It has all of the starting materials that we started with. Those starting materials may be present in more or less concentrations depending upon how well the reaction went. So these are the starting materials. This is the product. And then there's some byproducts that find their way into this chemical reaction as well. And we need to talk about those a little bit later about where those come from. But one of the byproducts is benzene. And one of the products, byproducts, is called biphenyl. So these guys are byproducts. And we need to remove all of those starting materials and byproducts and isolate just the product. And so that is done in the next step. The next step is called trituration. And I'll give you guys a second to catch up. And I'm actually looking at the clock and thinking, I didn't give you guys a break. Maybe this is a good spot to take a break for a minute. Why don't we take a 5-minute break? Let you guys catch up, get up out of the chair for a minute, and then we'll come back and we'll finish this out because we're pretty close to finishing this out. How does that sound? All right, let's come back.
Sounds good.
Okay, cool. Let's come back at like 10:17. That'll give us 5 minutes. And we'll finish this out. I'll put some music on. Give you guys a minute to get up and get around.
Hey, Jason. Jason, you still there?
Yep.
So I got logged off on the internet connection at Starbucks. I was wondering if you could go back at the step 2 and 3, if you can just hold it onto that page and I can maybe read that over.
Absolutely. You got it. Let me do that
Thank
for you.
Thank you so much.
Let me go back to share. I'll do it this way. I will do share that and sound. And that will allow me to accomplish both. Okay, so Brian, you got to go back. How far back?
Just to step 2 and 3. Perfect. Here. Yeah. Okay.
You got it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, coming back. That was a short break, or it seemed like a short break. I always get caught up. I get into those breaks and I decide to check my email, which is the worst thing I could possibly do during a break. Because as soon as I'm checking my email, then the break's over. I'm like, I never even got out of my chair. I just answered two emails and I'm done. All right, let's go ahead and put this back in the screen share. Get us back working. All right, so we were at the step here after rotovapping, we get the sticky solid of this residue, and this residue contains a number of different things. We've got the product, the triphenyl methanol that we're after, we've got benzophenone and bromobenzene that were starting materials, we've got benzene itself and biphenyl that are byproducts, and we've got to separate out these components to isolate just the product. And what's fortunate in this is that these materials have very different solubility profiles, that when we take all of these materials into effect, most of these guys over here, these guys are all pretty much nonpolar. And the triphenyl methanol, while mostly nonpolar, has some polarity. It has some polarity because it's got that hydroxyl group. And the hydroxyl group and the ability for it to be able to hydrogen bond gives it some of its polarity there. And so we can use the polarity difference between these to really isolate them. And you say, well, wait a minute, hold on. That benzophenone has a ketone in it. And yes, it does, but a ketone is not nearly as polar as a hydroxyl group. So once we put an alcohol in that thing, the hydroxyl group is way more polar than a carbonyl. And so these guys here are pretty much nonpolar. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use the solubility, polarity versus nonpolar, in order to separate them out. And we do that with petroleum ether. So petroleum ether, if we take these guys and we think about this as a separation scheme, and I'll go through a full separation scheme for you in a little bit later. Petroleum ether is a hydrocarbon. It's a mix of C4 through C6 isomers. Despite its name, it's not an ether. It's hydrocarbon. And so it's named petroleum ether. It gets the ether name because of its volatility, because it is a boiling fraction of hydrocarbon, much like kerosene, or there's a number of different named boiling fractions, kerosene being one. I'm trying to remember the other one, petroleum ether and mineral spirits. There's a number of different constant boiling fractions of hydrocarbon that they use for different things, and petroleum ether being one of them. And because it's one of the most volatile, they put the name ether to it, but it's an old name and it doesn't really tell you the functional group that's in there. So it's really just hydrocarbon. And what we get is we get a solid and we get a liquid when we add this petroleum ether into it. And the solid is the non-soluble triphenyl methanol. So this thing precipitates out. And the others with the petroleum ether stay in solution. And so we get over here, we get the benzene, we get the biphenyl. You can do these by name. I always like to include them by structure, just because sometimes I find that it makes it easier visually to track what's going on, doing them by structure.
When you just hear it, do you visualize it like properly in your head every time, or are you just kind of like?
I do. I see in structure more than I see in words. And so, yes, as I'm looking at this, And I didn't write what we do here. What we do here in this step, this is called a trituration. Triturate with petroleum ether. And trituration, this step literally means to wash. It's a wash step because what it's doing is it's removing the impurities in solution, but leaving behind the solid. It's washing the solid dry, or washing the, not dry, washing the solid clean is a way of saying it. So we call that a trituration, and you triturate with petroleum ether. And once we triturate that, usually we mix it, we warm it and mix for like 5 minutes. And then we filter it on Hirsch funnel. And after you filter it on Hirsch funnel, then we weigh the solid. Essentially, at this point, the reaction is almost done. Step number 11 would be to recrystallize. And we recrystallize this from isopropanol to propanol, also called isopropanol. And then step number 12 is you get your final mass. You take a melting point or several. And we calculate percent yield. I think we're also doing IR on this. We do a solid potassium bromide or solid IR. And then calculate your percent yield. And that's the whole experiment. And these guys, the melting point, the solid IR, these are all done in the video and explained. So they're fully demonstrated and explained in how everything works in the video. And actually, I even show you the melting points. So you actually see through the camera of the melting point device. And I did it with two cameras. So I had one camera that was filming the melting point, and I had another camera that was filming the thermometer. And I do it on a dual screen so that you can actually record your melting points as you're watching. And I try to do a good job of explaining what it is you're actually seeing. With the IR, I go through the entire IR process and how we make a KBR pellet out of this and do the solid IR. So all of that's explained in the video. In teaching you how to go through and do it. So the only thing here that I haven't done really is showing you the separation scheme. And so I think it's worth it to show a separation scheme and show where everything goes. And let's start it on a new page. Let's do it here. Separation schemes are an important way of understanding a chemical reaction. They start at the point where you first start to take things and put them into different locations. And so when we complete the reaction, the completed reaction has all of these things in it. It has the alkoxide adduct that we made. So we're going back to the point where the reaction just ended. We have this guy that has the magnesium, and it has the bromide. That was the product that we made. In addition to that, there was some magnesium that was leftover magnesium. There was some starting materials. So we always list all the starting materials. We had benzophenone. We had bromobenzene. Those are our starting materials. We had solvent, which was the diethyl ether, which I'll list that way. And we also had our byproducts that I need to show you kind of where these come from. But we had benzene as a byproduct, and we had biphenyl as a byproduct. So we list everything that could possibly be made and everything that was used in the process. And then from here, we look at the first point where I add something that creates a separation of layers. And that was the 6-molar HCl. And it creates two phases. One phase was an aqueous phase, and one phase was an organic phase. I'm sorry, there's a third phase. There's three phases that get created here. Let's take, and besides aqueous, let's make this line a little bit longer. And let's say aqueous and gas and organic. So these are the three different things that come out of this. And in the aqueous layer, we're getting water. We're getting magnesium salts. These could be chlorides and bromides. We're also getting some HCl that may be unreacted, and all of that is ending up in the water layer. In the gas layer, this is where we were generating hydrogen gas, and that's bubbling out. And in the organic layer, we always start with the solvent, diethyl ether, and then everything else that's organic is ending up in that organic layer. But this time, when we do the triphenyl methanol, it's now protonated because we've added in the HCl. So this is a combination of a chemical reaction and an isolation step, in that it's removing some things. So we get the OH, we get all those other starting materials. And again, like I said, I like to do them by structure, but if you want to do them by name to save space, nothing wrong with that. It's just, I kind of like to tie them together so that I understand why they're being separated in the way that they are. Oh, and the other thing that winds up over here is some water. Water winds up in that organic layer. And we don't just do this once. No, I guess we did do this step once. It's the next step that we do that is the pre-drying step. So on this next step, we take and we add in the brine, the saturated sodium chloride. And this creates two layers for us. So this creates an aqueous layer and an organic layer. And the reason that I'm moving aqueous and organic to different sides is only to try to make my flow diagram stay central for all the things that I'm trying to separate. So there's no rules on which side becomes organic and which side becomes aqueous. I'm just trying to move things around to make it a little bit easier. And what happens in the aqueous layer here is I'm getting water and I'm getting sodium chloride. And in the organic layer, it's all those other things. And so I got to sit down and I got to draw them all again. Now on an iPad, I would copy and paste, but I know that's completely uncool when you guys are trying to keep up with me. So I'm just going to sit down and draw them all over again. And then you guys can keep up and keep notes. Then I'm not overwhelming you. All right, so we get that guy. We get benzophenone. We get bromobenzene. We get benzene. We get biphenyl. And of course, I can still overwhelm you because I don't have to think about these structures as much. We still have diethyl ether that's in here. And we still have some water that's in here. So now we've pulled out a large amount of water. Now we're going to pull out the rest of the water. This step is where we go through and we treat it with magnesium sulfate. So we bring in MgSO4 as a solid. Now here, I'm going to have to spread it onto the next page. So I'm going to take this step and let's say that this is solid and this is liquid. In the solid, we're ending up with magnesium sulfate heptahydrate. And in the liquid, we're ending up with the diethyl ether and the organics, which I'm going to draw on the next page. And then we'll continue that separation. So we've got diethyl ether, we've got triphenyl methanol, we've got benzophenone. Bromobenzene, benzene itself, and biphenyl. And now this is dry. Now there's no water in it. Now that we've removed all the water, now we can remove the next solvent. So the next thing that we do is rotovap. Now you can say rotovap, that works, or you can say heat. Because that's literally what we're doing, is we're just evaporating the solvent and we're driving it off as a gas and we're getting a solid residue.
Is it distillation if you keep the stuff that goes into vapor phase and recondenses?
Well, we do actually recondense it on a rotovap. So we do recondense it as a liquid. So we could put liquid there, but we're driving it off as a gas. We're recondensing it as a liquid. And it's not really distillation unless your purpose is to recover that liquid as a product. So distillation is a way of purifying. And here we're not really purifying the diethyl ether as much as we're just trying to get rid of the diethyl ether.
Got it.
And so this is just a rotovap step. So the gas, the liquid, this is going to become our diethyl ether. It's being removed. And our solid residue has all of our products in it. Let's draw them all over again. My barky dogs, bromobenzene, benzene, and biphenyl. Now we do the trituration step. So now what we do is we take and we add in petroleum ether. This is the trituration. This step gives us a liquid and a solid. The liquid is the petroleum ether. That can't be represented structurally because it's a mixture of all different isomers. There's probably 20 different compounds that are in petroleum ether. So it's all hydrocarbon and we just listed as petroleum ether. But what does come out of this is all of the nonpolar components. That's going to be the benzophenone, the bromobenzene, the benzene itself, the biphenyl, all of those guys come out over here. And then in the petroleum ether, at the solid that's left behind after we filter it, we get the triphenyl methanol. And then the way that I deal with this next step, because we got the recrystallization that comes after this, and you say, well, why do I need to do a recrystallization? If the petroleum ether did its job, why do I then need to go and do a recrystallization? Because there's small impurities that remain here. Those impurities are small amounts of these other nonpolar constituents that are left behind, and we've got to remove those impurities. And so that step is where we do the recrystallization. This is the 2-propanol.
So Jason, if we had several impurities still in our end product, would it just be kind of like a slushy kind of material? Would it not stack nicely in like a crystalline form?
That is one indication, Brian. It depends upon the melting point of the product. If the melting point of the product is close to room temperature and you have impurities on it, it would depress the melting point enough to make it sludgy. If the melting point of the product is above 100 degrees or someplace like really high, then it probably wouldn't depress it enough to make it sludgy. It probably would look solid and look good, but its melting point would be depressed.
Gotcha.
Great question. Okay, so recrystallization, what we get is we get the liquid, we get the solid, and the liquid here is the 2-propanol and the impurities, and the solid is the triphenyl methanol, and we are done, and we're on to the characterization point now. Now we can take our melting points, our IR, and all that other stuff that we would want to do for the characterization.
So now how pure do you think it is once you're done with this, if you do it reasonably?
I would say that if you did one recrystallization, that there is probably some detectable impurities that are there. You're probably 98%, 99% pure. If you did a GC, you would probably see some impurities in it. You're not going to detect impurities by IR at that level. GC would allow you to see some of those impurities, or a mass spec GC would allow you to see some of those impurities. If you did 2 or 3 recrystallizations, now you're at 99.8, 99.9. You're starting to get pretty darn close to having an absolutely pure material. But one recrystallization is sufficient for what we need to do. All right, so this is a separation scheme. Separation scheme starts at the point where the reaction ends. And this is the first point where we take two things and put them in two different containers. That's always where you start a separation scheme. So reactions, you add. The first time you take and you separate things, that's where a separation scheme starts. And what you do is you put in the material that is causing the separation, you throw it in to the vertical line, and then you put in your phases, the different phases that you're creating. And then you just list out all the different things that go into each phase. And you go all the way through every single step, each place where you're separating it out, until you get down to that final product. And that allows you, when you start to learn how to do a separation scheme, that's where you really start to learn why you're doing the steps, as opposed to just doing the steps. And now you have a visual representation of the entire reaction and the entire isolation process of how we go through and separate things out. This gives you the reason why you're doing things, as opposed to just doing them. So that's an important thing to be able to do, is to be able to do the separation scheme. Okay. So what I would say here is that what I would really like you guys to do is I would really like you guys to watch those sets of videos. There's the 4 videos for the triphenyl methanol. And while you're watching it, you don't have to use a notebook, but it'd be a good idea if you did to kind of set up a laboratory notebook and to take notes as if you were, let me go ahead and stop this. Take notes as if you were doing a laboratory notebook from the video, meaning that you're taking down all of the observations that you would normally. You're taking down the masses, you're taking down the tear weights, and then you're going back and you're going to be calculating out what the mass of each one of those materials is, what the limiting reagent is in the chemical reaction from the 3 components that are the reactants. You have the magnesium metal, you have the bromobenzene, and you have the benzophenone. Those are the three components that you're adding. And one of those three becomes a limiting reagent. And that limiting reagent is what you base your percent yield on. And then I think that after the weekend, when we come back on Monday, what I'd like to do is talk formal reports, and we can deal with any sort of questions that come up in the videos and what you're seeing. And I'll show you guys some formal reports. We'll talk about what it is that I want for the formal report, and then we'll set a due date for that formal report. And I think the due date will be the following week, if not maybe even a little bit later, giving you guys some time to write and work on that formal report. Okay? Does that sound like a game plan?
Sounds like a game plan.
All right, so you guys know what you need to do. You need to go watch those videos and make some notes on those videos as you're watching those videos. Okay, and then I know you may not have a lot of experience writing formal reports, but that's where we'll talk in the next session. We'll talk mostly about formal reports and what it is I'm gonna be looking for, okay? All right, so that gives us a little bit of break here. It gives us a half an hour before lecture starts, so we come back at 11:15 and we'll pick it up with the alkenes at 11:15.
Thanks.
Okay, so we're good to go. If you guys want to stay or ask any other questions, I'm happy to answer any other questions you guys might have. I'll hang out for a little bit. Otherwise, I'll see you at 11:15.